Hello everyone, my name is Daniel and I'm going to talk about LMRV and how to make open source chips. So LMRV is a collection of end-to-end open source RISC-V microcontrollers. End-to-end in this context means it's open source from design files to tape-out ready GDS2 files. It's available in multiple platforms for different applications, and those are based on element names. So it's just a combination of elements and RISC-V. They are fully written in Spinal HDL, and they are licensed under the CERN Open Hardware Language W2.0 and support an FPGA and ASIC flow. The history of LMRV is tightly coupled to the IHP, the Innovations for High Performance Microelectronics. This is a publicly funded research institute in Germany. They focus on silicon germanium electronics. They operate a small pilot line in Germany where they produce their research projects. And for example, they produce high-speed transistors. That's what they focus on. And they're located in Frankfurt, Oder, Germany. They had two key fundings a couple of years ago. One is a 130 nanometer open source PDK. And another is free MPWs runs to validate those analog and digital components. So they had a lot of analog designs, but they lacked digital designs for these free MPW runs. I already had RISC-V designs for FPGAs, and I also wrote an hyperbus interface for those. So I got asked through connections if I want to port those to and make tape out. And as you can see on this image, this is the first tape out of LMRV. It's a flat design. It's the design philosophy is pretty conservative. It's an alpha PDK, and the goal was just get bootable silicon. I received those silicons last year in February. There was one bug in the hyperbus interface. Basically, it's unable to run data and instruction the same time in the external memory. All other core functions were working, and it was the first booting silicon with the IHP Open PDK. Technically, it's the first booting silicon in Europe, like the first open source microcontroller. And the cool thing about this is there's no NDK required, so this is end-to-end open source. I did a second tape out in April last year. I fixed the hyperbus interface. Now it's actually running Sapphire Atos. I got an on-chip RAM. That's the small yellow two bars on the left, bottom left. I got more I.O., more interfaces to silicon proof. I got a PinMux controller and a mask IIS, because there's a research team in Germany that's trying to break the mask IIS implementation. All right, so let's talk about the architecture. This is the Nitrogen, the more powerful platform. It's using a VEX RISC-V CPU. Then it's going through a BMP interconnect. This has an SPI XIP controller, so it's communicating to external SPI flash. It has the on-chip RAM and a hyperbus for external memory. And all peripherals are connected through a wishbone bus and then going to through PinMux to the I/O pad. All right, so the VEX RISC-V, I think that's a pretty famous or familiar CPU now. It's a 32-bit RISC-V CPU designed in 5 stages. It's fully written in Spinal HDL. It's actually written by Charles Perpone, the maintainer and inventor of Spinal HDL. It's a plugin based architecture, so you can define your CPU with a list of configuration and plugins. And in this architecture, it has the I extension, the full integer base extension, which is mandatory. It has the hardware multiply and divide extension, the seek extension for compressed instructions, so 16-bit instructions, and the control and status registers. All right, so the wishbone, that's actually the biggest change now from the first two silicon revisions. The hyperbus issue was actually an issue in the AXI port. And AXI 4 is a very complicated bus interface, a bus for and a very maybe too complicated for small microcontrollers. The specification is also very hard to implement and also to read. There are a lot of people that actually have questions or problems with that. And the biggest problem is it's an open specification, but it's still owned by Arm Limited. So that's a risk. And the replacement for AXI4 is now the Banana Memory Bus, written by Charles Pepone II. It's a simple command and request channel architecture. So AXI4, for example, has 5 channels. This has only 2. And it's replacing completely the AXI4 crossbar. The problem is BMP, like AXI4, is a point-to-point bus. And there's also a requirement for a new bus for APB3. And Wishbone actually supports shared subordinates or shared slaves. So Wishbone is the replacement for ABB3. Okay, this is an overview of the bus architecture. So on the left side, you can see the instruction and data port. They're going through a decoder, the hyperbus and the on-chip RAM. They have an arbiter because both the instruction and data port have access to those. The data port only has access to the wishbone, so you cannot read instructions from peripherals. And the data port has no access to the external SPI flash because this is right now only read-only. Speaking of SPI flash, so this is the there's an SPI XIP controller. That's how it's called. That's for reading from an external SPI flash. The problem is those have they have a communication protocol that needs to be implemented. So typically that's a command. Then you need to send an address. You might need to send or include dummy cycles, and then you can read or write to an SPI flash. So in this case, this is a dual mode controller. It includes the normal SPI controller to handle the SPI transaction. And then on top is the SPI XIP controller that implements the SPI flash protocol. And this time it has also the runtime switchable I/O protocols. Normally SPI flashes, they boot in a single bit mode, a standard mode. This controller can switch to dual or quad mode. So you can increase the bandwidth of the SPI flash. And then there's also the hyperbus interface, as mentioned. The problem is that the IHP is 130 nanometers, so this is SRAM is really expensive in 130 nanometer. External SRAM devices are very small and very expensive. SDRAM, on the other side, they are big and cheap, but they have a quite complex interface. Hyperbus, this is an Octa SPI-like interface, so this has a very low I/O count. There are only 11 mandatory pins, plus as many chip selects as wanted. You can connect HyperRAM and HyperFlash devices. So RAM is volatile and flash are non-volatile devices on the same bus. And the throughput is up to 800 megabyte per second. I don't know if you can see this on this chip. So this is a 64 I/O chip. On the top, there's a small red rectangle. Those are the hyperbus IOs. As you can see, one bank is already gone for hyperbus, for memory only. And on the right side, the blue, this is only SPI. So almost 50% of all chips are gone for external memory and flash. All right, so that's about the architecture. Let's talk about the ASIC flow. So this is a very, very simplified overview. So you need a seal ring, and you also need your design files or RTL. Then the OpenFlow is using OpenRoad, so we're going to convert those into a GDS2 file. Then we need to add metal dummy filler, and then at the end we're going to do the design rule check. All right, so EDA tools, they normally only understand Verilog and VHDL. Normally, the commercial and open source EDA tools only understand Verilog. For example, OpenRoad is using EOSIS. LMRV is written in Spinely HDL, so you cannot feed your Spinely HDL files directly into the EDA tools. But Spinely HDL is a Scala-based framework to actually generate Verilog or VHDA code. And the advantage is that it's a high-level language, so you can actually use modern programming constructs, but you can also use the entire Scala or Java infrastructure in the background. For example, you can use file IO to actually read data from files. All right, so next we need a C-ring, or sometimes it's called guard ring. That is basically just a ring around the entire chip on all metal layers, and it's to seal off or to guard the chip itself. It has multiple purposes during during the lifetime of a chip. So first, during manufacturing, it's blocking the ionic contamination during manufacturing. Then, when it's reducing the mechanical stress when separating dyes from the wafer, it's also stopping cracks going into the core or the chip from the edges. And during lifetime, it's preventing getting moisture into the chip from the outside, from these edges. And as you can see on this image, this is a cut through of the IHP C-ring. On the bottom, that green is the active layer. Then you have five smaller metal layers and two big top metal layers. And in between are just the vias. All right, so next step is generating the GDS2 file. So we have our C-ring, we have RTL. You also need a lot some config files for OpenRoad, but you know, ignore this now. Anyhow, so the first step is convert the RTL into netlist. This is done by using EOSIS, for example, with OpenRoad. Then next is doing the building the floor plan and doing the power grid. And again, on this image, you can see these squares on the outside. Those are the bond pads. Then you have the I/O ring next to them. This is for the I/O voltage rail and the core voltage rail. And then next to them, this is on the inside. This is the power and ground ring. And in the inside, this is the core area. But we're going to ignore this because that's not placed yet. It's just the I/O ring bond pads. But the chip is layout, so the size is already defined. So the next step is actually building the core. So first, OpenRoad will start placing the standard cells on some estimations. Then it will connect those standard cells, or will build the clock tree by connecting those to the standard cells. Next, it will do the global and detailed routing between the standard cells. And finally, it's doing a parasitic extraction, so it's getting the RC and L values of those traces, and then doing the timing analysis. So if those analysis, if they meet the requirements, it's done, but normally that's not on the first run. So it's going, if there are problems with the parasitics, the electric or the timings, then it's going back to the placement of standard cells, and it's trying to optimize things, and it's doing all this again. So it's doing a lot of iterations until no violations are found. And finally, it's doing the physical verification and then do sign-off. And now on the, you can see now it's actually placing the C-ring. That's on this image on the outside. I don't know, you might see this barely. There's this C-ring here. All right, so now we have our GDS2 file, but it's not production ready. So next we need to add, the problem is that we have, go back. So you can see on the, for example, the top metal 2, that's what you see mostly. There are a lot of bond pads at the I-rings, they have a lot of metal. There are some power strips on top metal 2, but there's nothing else on top metal 2. So the metal density is pretty much undistributed over the entire chip right now. And doing chemical, mechanical polishing, you get a different thickness of those layers. That's a problem because you want to build next layers on top, and then you have uneven layers. But you also get actually smaller electric traces, which means you have unpredictable electrical characteristics, something you don't want. And the solution is to add, to just add dummy metal into the layout. You can see this again on the top. This is top metal 2. Those are really big shapes. And the idea is just calculate the metal density on a tile. For example, IHP is using 800 by 800 micrometer. And you get the metal density. IHP is also, they defined a minimum and maximum metal density for this layer. And then you try to fill for a desired metal density. And then you get these metal shapes just into the layout. But you can also see there are some layers, they don't have metal here in this image because they probably have a lot of routing architecture in the core, so they don't need metal here. But you can also see on the bottom these green and red overlapping, those are the active and gate poly layers, so also the transistor layers obviously need metal fill. Okay, the last step is design rule check. There are a lot of fabs on this in this world. Some fabs in this world. They have different tools. They have different experience. They have different. They call this recipes. They also have different process nodes. So this is why they always have unique, pretty much unique design rules. And they provide this, but on the other hand, you have tools like OpenRoute. They cannot check for all design rules because they focus on getting a layout. If they would check for all design rules, this would take too much time. It's very complex. So the last step of doing a tape-already design is basically running design rule checks. And for this example, those are the layout rules for top metal 1. I mean, top metal is a pretty simple layer, so it's a good example. But this has two important rules. The first one is it's inside the highest yellowish shape. So this defines the minimum top metal 1 width, and that's 1.64 micrometer. The problem is if it's too narrow, you might get disconnected traces or something else. And the other rule is B, that's the top metal 1 space or notch. So that defines the minimum space between two top metal 1 shapes. And that's also 1.64 micrometer. The problem is if they're close together, you get maybe shorts during production. So that's what you want to make sure that doesn't happen. That sounds simple. That's probably the most exhausting step because if you're 2 days ahead of the tape, this is a hard deadline and you have design rules, you question your life. All right, so this is not using makefile, it's LMIV is using task file to implement this flow. The flow is basically divided into 4 steps. So you need to do a task prepare. This is generating the Verilog code from the spinal HDL. It's also generating the OpenRoute config files, etc. Then it's generating C-ring macros, or the C-ring macro. Next is just run task layout. Then it's starting OpenRoute to generate the GDS2 file. Next is doing the task filler. It's adding filler. And then at the end, it's just task run DSC. And that probably takes the most time to do the DSC check. And that's basically it. So the HP funding is over since December. So they now provide OpenSilicon MPW shuttles now with this OpenPDK. It's 1,500 euros per square millimeter, but it's only for open source designs. So I think you can make them actually with Cadence, that's fine, but you need to open those designs. You need to upload them to the GitHub repository. They have 3 tape-out dates this year, now in March. The CMOS, that's only digital, in July the CMOS 5L. So this housing has 5 metal layers. It has 4 normal metal layers and 1 top metal. And in October, the G2, that's with the high-speed bipolar transistors. And if you're interested, you can register. Or this is the same link on the bottom. If you don't trust my QR code. the minimum requirement is actually 1 square millimeter, as far as I know. So you can actually make pretty cheap chips for research, for your hobby projects, for your company. The only requirement is has to be open source. Oh, sorry, I skipped one slide. All right, so for LMAV, I reserved 7 square millimeter on this next tape out shuttle. I would like to do some performance improvements, for example, more hyperbus performance, adding CPUs to the Rexus 5 based on SRAM blocks, and also adding more partitions with different clocks. Right, so if you're interested in doing high quality images based on your GDS2 files, this is Blender GDS. It's an important Blender add-on for importing GDS2 files directly into Blender, and then you can use Blender's cyclic engine to do high quality images based on, like, this is using ray tracing and all this computer vision stuff. And obviously, LMAV is also open source. So if you are looking for FPGA-based microcontrollers, or you want to tape out your own microcontroller, they are LMAV is silicon-proven. You can use this on the open source silicons, report bugs or issues, request features. That's basically it. Feel free to connect me on several platforms. Thank you. Memory bus.
Have you run any performance test comparison between the two of them, like throughput and latency?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious if you have numbers.
Yeah, so the question was if I did performance tests on the BMP versus XC4. I did not so far, but I was able to improve the chip clock, actually. So before I was actually almost like 55 megahertz with the IHP, and now it's getting up to 80. So I get faster clock now, but I haven't checked. I assume it's not really bad because I use the spinal HDL implementation of XC4, which has the shared address bus. So it's just four XC channels instead of 5, so it's not an official XC4 implementation. But no, I'm done. That was another question, yeah?
When you get DRC violations, when you're trying to make ASIC, what do you do next? How do you influence the...
The question was, when you have DRC issues, what should you do? Sometimes you just have to take a look into OpenRoad, for example, and see if there are issues in your config. For example, your bond pads could be located too close to the C-ring. Then you just need to increase your chip. We already had an OpenRoad bug where it actually made two big metal sheets between vias, and the solution was going into the design and manually fix all those, just make them bigger, because there was only 30 violations. Sometimes you just need to fix this, but mostly it's an issue with your configuration. You get more issues when you do analog designs, when you draw everything by yourself. Then you get a lot more issues. Yep, there's one more, and then you. Yep.
Hey, question is that Vic's spies normally have been used for FPGA generally. When you ported it to an ASIC, apart, so it had, it normally on FPGA you have VRAM and all, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you moved it, now you started using your own memory cells and yeah, whatever, with the hyperbus and all. Apart from that, did you, apart from these memory bus replacement, did you do any change in the RTL design, or you actually?
Okay, the question was if I did any changes to the VEX RISC-V. So far, I did not. So right now, it's using not as, so it's using just standard cells for the register file, for example. But I'm working on the caches right now based on these SRAM blocks, because otherwise it would be too big. Yeah, so that trying to do that now. IHP has no SRAM blocks that are 3-port, 32 by, what is this, 32? That's the problem. It's too small for IHP. There was one question
you
here.
You mentioned must IS on the design. Did it work?
I mentioned what, sorry?
Must IS? IS?
Oh, the mask IS. I don't know. The question was if the mask IS is working. I don't know, because the chip is at IHP and they're doing the silicon interposer right now, the PCB interposer right now. So I hope I get the chip in 4 weeks. I think that was one last question.
Is there
Which extension? Oh, the question was if the vector extension is implemented. I don't know for this VEX RISC-V, might be for the new VEX RISC-V2. I don't know. I don't have it. I think there might be someone else here who's more familiar with VEX RISC-V. I don't know right now. That's it, no question? Do we have time for one question? All right, yeah. Which other parts? A PLL, I got the PLL, but... Oh, if there are mixed signal parts on this chip. No. So the question was if there are mixed signal parts on this design. No, because IHP has no PLL right now. They're working on this. I think that's now another funding project. IHP is publicly funded, so this is everything needs to be funded, and it's a little bit slower. But they're working on the PLL right now and POR and stuff like this. So they work on analog designs. They're working on an ADC also right now. So this is all coming now. This should be for free too, part of this open silicon. So you can pick those from the analog library. But currently not, unfortunately. Right. Thank you again.